CKUW 95.9 FM, homegrown in Winnipeg.
Segment of our show, Taya Aguias will be giving us an update on her modified dance work. So, what are your plans for your modified dance classes for the year ahead?
Okay, so for 2025, my goals for Sunshine's dance classes are to get more community involvement and to get more in-person classes as opposed to online classes, to hopefully see a change and a difference in the confidence built in the dancers by being around other dancers and their peers. I really believe that strength can be built in numbers, and my hope is just to see how strong the individuals can get within themselves. I've seen a huge amount of change in one particular dancer that comes to my drop-in classes weekly. They're constantly evolving in their technique, but most importantly, their confidence in themselves to show their dance moves to me and to the dancers, and to even like their parents in the dance moves and the dances that they create has like grown exponentially. And I also see a huge difference in coordination as well as muscle memory in the dancers that I see in person. I still believe that online dance classes are very beneficial and they're a great way to improve movement goals and increase endorphins and happiness. But my main year for this year, or my main goal for this year, is just to get more community involvement and see more of that confidence built within the dancers.
So, do you find that the confidence and the skill they build up in dance class is a transferable skill that might strengthen their overall persona as they go through life?
Yeah, 100%. I agree with that.
So, how are you reaching out to the community to build more of a client base and recruit new dancers?
That's still a work in progress. I definitely would like to reach out to more Windsor-based organizations that are easier accessible for them to come to, like, either drop in classes or to see if they would like to do joints, maybe even if it's just like a dance party for their, the people that are within their organization, or if it's, once a month get togethers just to kind of improve, that confidence to build within themselves and just to kind of get my name out there. That's kind of the main goal. Obviously, I would still love to do online classes for people who maybe aren't close to Windsor or Essex County, that would still like to be involved in dance classes with Sunshine Dance Studios. I'm still very open to that. But my main focus, I think, for this year is just really focusing on Windsor Essex County and the close partnerships that I can hopefully create within.
So, for those who might have missed our prior interviews, what sort of modified techniques do you use for a dancer with a disability?
So, a lot of the modified techniques that I use are based in, like, kind of the training that I've had. So, I like to do hand-on-hand. That's really helpful, I think, when a dancer is confused on what they can do, kind of by moving their body in the way that I'm asking them to, helps them to kind of understand and see how they should be doing it, as well as, always praising when they're doing a good job. That's, I find, really helpful too. But giving modifications when needed is, I think, the best tool to do. If someone can't spin, then, I can give them a different dance move to do instead of a turn, because ultimately the dancer knows their body best. So I want to work within their scope and within like what they know that they can and can't do, but at the same time kind of pushing them to be better for confidence reasons, but without any added pressure. I never want to add pressure on them. I wanted them to just have like super amounts of fun. That's really the main goal. But I'd say like those are my main ways that I would use like adaptive or modified learning techniques with them.
So with the new year upon us, is there any success moment from the past year that really stands out for you that you'd like to share?
Yeah, I think the moment that really stood out for me was actually this past week, or last week, I guess, where I only had one drop-in dancer for, sorry, I do drop-in classes and only one dancer showed up, which is totally okay. So it was just me and her, and we were kind of just goofing around doing whatever she wanted since it was right before the new year. It was a very chill, laid-back class. So we decided to just put on one of her favorite songs, and I just let her do whatever she wanted. And she did just the most beautiful improv dance that I've seen her do ever. And the confidence that she exuded was, like, amazing. It brought me to tears. It made me so happy and so proud. And just to see her progress from, like, a couple years ago till now, or even within the last year, just the confidence that she built made me so happy. And it was just like, it felt like such a success, not only for her, but for me to just see how her improvement has gone. And it just made me so, so, so happy.
So when you have a moment like that, how do the friends and family of the dancers tend to respond?
Her mom was in the room for it, and I could tell that her mom was also very proud. I don't know if she dances like that at home, but that was one of the first times that I seen her go that in depth with her dance moves. And I could tell that her mom was also so proud. So I get a lot of really good feedback from parents often saying that the dance classes are really good. And either whether it's just like a fun outlet for the child, or if it's maybe an outlet for the dancer to meet other dancers or meet other peers of theirs, and kind of like become part of this like community or this group, this fun little family that we've kind of built, I get a lot of feedback from parents saying that it's just like so good for their child, for their dancer, as well as just fun.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Cam.
Of course. In this segment of our show, Janelle Shaw will be telling us about the Arts Accessibility Network of Manitoba. So what can you tell me about the network?
Well, Arts Accessibility Network Manitoba is a charitable-run organization that's dedicated to the full inclusion of artists, audiences, and arts workers with disabilities into all facets of the arts community. So that comes out in a few ways. Some of it is one-on-one. So we do a lot of one-on-one mentoring to help our artists, you know, write an artist statement, how to submit artwork, how to write a grant, all the way to advocacy kind of things, where we do all accessibility audits or anti-ableist workshops for the arts. And we also have monthly exhibitions. So we're really much like an art gallery as well as kind of an advocacy organization.
So how do you go about reaching out to the disability community to let them know that you are there to support their art?
Well, part of it is through the work that we do with our exhibitions, you know, and supporting artists that way. We get a lot of folks out coming for our first Friday in the exchange openings, which is a lot of fun. We also just really create a safe environment where folks with disabilities feel comfortable. They know that their needs will be met, that they can, you know, ask any accommodation. Or it's a disability-led organization, and so I think because of that, the community knows it's a safe place. We've also been around since 2008. So we've been in the community for quite some time. And so, you know, folks know about us, and we're just slowly getting bigger and bigger in the last few years. But a lot of it is really about just creating that safe place and community connection.
So I'm guessing when you mentioned anti-ableism workshops, that you'd speak to some of the myths or misperceptions surrounding disabilities.
Absolutely. If we're talking in terms of artistry, that's something that's kind of, you know, all your house at AANM. Some of the misperceptions is that artists with disabilities create work that's either recreational or therapeutic and not necessarily professional. So that's something that we really have been advocating for quite some time, that, you know, the artists that we work with are professional. This is their career. They should be paid as other artists are paid, not asked to show their work for exposure, which happens quite often. And there's also this idea that if you create art with disability in mind, that it's therapeutic art, it's not real art. And so that's another thing that we've really been trying to fight against. I guess another one with the disability community is, you know, the infantilization. I'm going to struggle with that word. But treated as children and not treated respectfully as others are, especially those who have who aren't able to speak. Them especially are viewed as less intelligent or not independent. While that, you know, that can be very far from the truth. Just because someone doesn't speak doesn't mean that their mind doesn't work, or that, you know, if their body moves differently, doesn't mean that their mind is impacted. Or even if their mind is impacted, doesn't mean that they aren't able. Able to be artists and able to live in the world. So those are some of the myths that we talk about at the ableism workshops.
So what are some of the modified pieces of equipment and techniques some of the artists would use having various disabilities?
Absolutely. So there could be a variety of things. In terms of showing work, one of the things that we do is we have our artwork slightly lower than what the average is, and so that if folks are using mobility devices where they sit in, they're able to view the artwork comfortably. We also ensure that we don't use any cleaning products or scents and that sort of thing for those folks who have respiratory issues. In terms of like adaptive technology for artists, there's different things such as hand braces that can allow you to hold your hands in a longer position. There's certain software that helps with voice command to create digital art. So it really depends on the individual and what their kind of access needs are.
So in your time with the organization, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you?
Yeah, absolutely. We've had a lot of really great successes. In 2012, we held the first Disability Art Festival here in Manitoba. So that was very exciting for us to be able to kind of present our artists to the world, to the Manitoban culture. But really, the things that I really take away is the one-on-one work we do with folks. We have a lot of artists who say that having someone be able to tell you exactly how to, you know, get grads and how to write these things is really important. A lot of people, even if they graduate with a fine arts degree, one of the things they don't teach you at art school is how to make a living as an artist, how to, you know, be able to get those grants and how do you get funding. And so that's a gap that we fill. And I've just had so many comments from artists saying, you know, thank you so much. This is, no one's ever offered to do this before, even though I've asked, and it's made such a big difference. So for me, it's really those one-on-one moments that I find are our biggest celebrations and achievements.
So any projects on the horizon?
Absolutely, yes. We are planning on creating an anthology of writers here in Manitoba, potentially across Canada as well. So that's very exciting. It'll be for any literary artist, whether it's poetry, whether it's academic writing, whether it's storytelling. So we're really excited for that project, and we're hoping to do that within the next year.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
Thanks. Andy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
How can you protect your keys? Simply attach a WarAmps key tag to your key ring. If you lose your keys, the WarAmps can return them to you by courier for free. WarAmps key tags, they're free and they work. Order yours at waramps.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Janelle Shaw told us a little bit about the Arts Accessibility Network of Manitoba, and we heard an update on Sunshine Dance Studios from Taya Aguias. This next segment of our show is a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Glenn Flood will be telling us a little bit about spinal cord injury PEI. So what can you tell me about spinal cord injury PEI?
Well, I've been the executive director for a little over 3 years, and we are part of a network across Canada, SCI Canada, which includes BC, Alberta, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Ontario, Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, and Prince Edward Island. It's an organization that's been around since the late 80s in PEI, and of course it derives from the World War II vets from the, as prior to being SCI PEI, I think it was 2014, before my time, but they changed from the Canadian Paraplegic Association to the Spinal Cord Injury Network. So we operate year-round. We have three full-time staff. I have seven part-time staff. Like our counterparts across the country, their peer program is our number one program. We have certified and trained peer leaders with SCIPEI, and presently you can do that through Alberta's organization, but we are presently sitting on a committee across the country where we are creating a national peer document that will fit everybody comfortably from tip to tip. So that will include more engagement and more education pieces as well. So SCIPEI is also a nonprofit organization. I have a board of directors of 12. So it's 50% of people living their life with a spinal cord injury, and 50% are able bodies. A high percentage of them are medical individuals within our province. So that's kind of SCIPEI. Again, I'm the executive director of it, in terms of what we are, who we are, I should say.
So what are some of the benefits of the peer program? I'd imagine that having shared experience with someone who's gone on the journey, so to speak, would be, if nothing else, an immense mental health relief to someone dealing with a fresh spinal cord injury.
Yeah, and actually, what I found in my 3+ years so far is the newly injured person, they don't want anything, most times they don't want anything to do with the organization. They perhaps are going through some stages of shock and grief. But once they, you know, perhaps deal with some initial stuff through rehab, and in PEI, you can do rehab at the QEH hospital, but there's a couple of spots not too far in New Brunswick, Stan Cassidy. So those setups are all the medical professionals that will, you know, work and assist with dealing with some of the initial stages after the SCI injuries. But yeah, once our peer folks get involved, and a lot of times you hear this later in an individual's life, but what a difference it made knowing there are other people out there living a similar life, getting through life, you know, as well as they can, dealing with the many barriers that can come with disability and mobility. And, yeah, so we're fortunate in our province that I was able to create a provincial peer committee, and Prince Edward Island is set up where it's Queens County, Kings County, and Prince County. And so I come from a long-serving sport background, and I always always believed in coaching, the importance of coaching, certification, all that sort of stuff. So I felt each community should have their own peer leader. I have two females involved as well. So our peer committee is up to at least six individuals. One of those is a nurse practitioner for spinal cord injury from the hospital. The rest are males and females living with spinal cord injury. So those peer meetings, like, that's the glue to the organization. Those folks are my home run hitters. They some of them have experienced decades living with spinal cord injury, and they might not know everything, but they certainly have seen everything. So it's invaluable not just to deal with life after the injury, but to also assist and work through provincial and federal opportunities that are out there. Could be adapting a home, adapting a vehicle, where to go to get resources on any topics that come up. And our website is not just our website in general, but our blog is one of the spots where we post any types of questions, no matter how uncomfortable the topic could be, to just perhaps a simple spot where to go to get an where's an accessible restaurant to go just to have lunch or something to that effect. So, yeah, the peer folks are what drive probably the network across Canada, and that's why we're working so hard to come together with a new document.
So, your time with SCI, has there been any success moment or story that stands out for you?
Yeah, I have a real passion for the disability topic. And, honestly, I could say a simple feeling personally I get just making phone calls to some of our members could be a moment just to hear how they appreciate you reaching out and whatnot, just to catching up or letting them know what's coming up or, some things to get involved with. So that's just kind of a personal good feeling. But I was able to get my organization to back myself to go train in British Columbia last March to be able to do accessibility reviews. That has become very, in the early stages, efficient and effective for our organization. Not only is it an opportunity to make some resources, it's breaking down the barriers of trying to become an accessible province. We've gotten some offers from some really large entities here at PEI, the largest university with their library. We just finished doing the tour of that one. So that is important, I believe, for the small present and then future big picture of mobility issues in the province. I think our seated fitness program that we've created a couple of years ago, it's a real positive opportunity for anybody in those programs. And that's a mobility disability, so it's anybody with a SCI injury, and then you name it. It could be cerebral palsy, MS, MD, stroke. So a lot of these folks are coming out being discharged from the hospital and don't really have a whole lot of follow-up anymore. So the program started with one pilot spot in Charlottetown with eight people. So we're now in four different areas in PEI, and we do an online one as well. So five programs in total, and probably about 100 individuals benefit from it. So, and I think we'll be moving into another community in the new year. So that's the plan. I'm meeting with somebody Monday to expand to a sixth community. So those are a couple of major highlights. And then I just think in general, we get a lot of positive comments in terms of day-to-day work we do for our members. It's always good to hear. And Yeah, I mean, there's another really cool event that we take part in. It's there's a Prince Edward Island Marathon race. It's one of the actually Boston Marathon qualifiers you must do. And actually, my organization's co-chair, she actually is one of the managers of that event. So I'm not sure how it started in terms of numbers and whatnot, but they do three events leading up to the major one. So we have, for the past year, been involved in all three races, a two-kilometer wheelchair race. So, and this year, the final event, I actually, just because it's a bit challenging to get enough wheelchairs, because it isn't just individuals in our organization, it's political individuals, folks that work in the medical field, myself. So it's not easy getting a whole bunch of wheelchairs for those sort of people, but we had 20 participants this past year just in the Charlton area. So that's a real feel-good story, and the fact that we've been in taking part in all three of the PEI Marathon events, and that event has kind of taken on a life of its own, where, because there's one, as I mentioned, in Queens County, one in Kings, one in Prince County. And now, through our peer leaders, those events will be probably populated even more. So, just again, a lot of growth in a short time. Certainly, you know, I'm not I don't do a very good job of taking my foot off the gas or relaxing. So I just feel, as great as things have gone, and there's been many positives, that there's really no time to slow down now, moving forward for our members and their families.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
I can.
Thanks. The thing I love about disability arts, my friends, is the unique capacity to bring a new perspective to the world of disabilities. A person might tend to be overlooked in mainstream society. However, if they create something beautiful and eye-catching, the world takes notice. They start to realize it's an expression of the soul of the creator. They come to realize that this is someone with something to say, entitled to the same dignity and respect as anyone else in society. You shouldn't talk around them. You should talk to them about their art. And that's really the beginning place where bridges start to be built. That a person with a disability might not communicate in a traditional manner, that's all right. But if they have an important message to be relayed through art, it still gets the point across. It's even more impactful in some ways. That, my friends, is where I think it all begins. Recognizing that someone with a disability, regardless of what that disability may be, has intelligence, dignity, wisdom to share. And using a medium like art can be a great way of getting able-bodied society to recognize, hey, there's more to this person than initially meets the eye. It's easy to take that first glance look and say, this is someone who can be overlooked. This is someone can't contribute much. But I maintain a person with a disability always has something to contribute. They always have something to say. The only question is, are we as a society going to be smart enough to listen and to grow in our own wisdom? This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on.